does not suggest that we were heading back to the peak years in 1988.
More oil might not signal a return to the good old days for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, Congress is back in session, just weeks from a new president. So what's changed for the Alaska delegation?
Do you solemnly swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
For the first time in over a decade, the operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System announced a year-over-year increase in the amount of oil moving through the pipeline. Last year, according to the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, the pipeline moved about 517,000 barrels per day. That's a 1.8% increase from 2015. Alyeska President Tom Barrett says he's happy to kick off TAP's 40th year with the announcement.
Every barrel that either stops the decline or slows it, or as in the last year, increases, is very positive for us as an operator.
Oil flowing through the pipeline peaked in 1988 at 2 million barrels per day. It's declined steadily ever since then, with small upticks in 1991, 2002, and now 2016. Department of Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner Mark Wagon says he can't point to a single factor behind the increase. There was a full year of production for ConocoPhillips' first development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The private company Hillcorp was also more active on the North Slope. And he says fewer North Slope facilities were shut down for maintenance last year. But Wagon says the state isn't predicting that TAPS will return to its glory days, at least not anytime soon.
The uptick that we witnessed in 2016, while very positive and it's the direction we wanted heading, surely does not suggest that we were heading back to the peak years in 1988.
In December, Alaska's Department of Revenue predicted oil production from the North Slope will continue its decline. By 2025, the state forecasts production could dip below 350,000 barrels per day. If oil flow is less than 300,000 barrels per day, Alyeska doesn't know if the pipeline can keep operating safely. Slow-moving oil in a cooler pipeline causes wax to build up. It's also likely that ice accumulation will become a bigger problem. Barrett says pipeline workers are already developing strategies to deal with issues caused by slow-moving oil and cold weather.
We've installed new pumps. We've installed methanol injection points. We use fired heaters to manage at this lower speed, which is really not what we were designed for.
Barrett says he's hopeful production will increase this year, too. But Alyeska has to plan for all scenarios, including a continued decline in production. It's the opening day of the new congressional session, and APRN's Washington correspondent, Liz Ruskin, is here to tell us about it. Liz, how's it going out there?
Hi, Ann. It's going well. It's a big day here with a lot of pomp and circumstance, as it is every 2 years on the first day of the new Congress. Of course, Congressman Don Young was sworn in again. This is his 23rd term he's starting. Senator Lisa Murkowski was sworn in by the vice president. That's how the Senate does it. And the vice president for the next few days is Joe Biden. And here's how the ceremonial swearing-in sounded.
Okay, your spouse.
Okay.
Oh, I'm senator.
You're senator. You give him the Bible.
Okay.
You give me the oath. Okay. You put your left hand in the Bible. Right. We got something going here.
That was Biden helping Senator Murkowski and her husband, Vern Martell, find their marks and, pose for the cameras. Then the vice president got pretty serious for the oath.
The purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you're about to enter, so help you God. I don't have a doubt about it.
So So maybe you can hear, but Biden loves events like these. And he was a lot of wisecracks from him. And I must say, a lot of corny jokes.
That actually sounds really fun. Was there any serious business today? I remember hearing that the House was going to vote to weaken their ethics policing.
Right. House Republicans were going to do that. And then there was a big hue and cry, and they decided not to do that. What they were going to do is lessen the independence of the Office of Congressional Ethics. Now, that office investigated a few years ago, investigated Congressman Young. And if you're wondering if he was part of this effort to weaken the office, no, he was not. His spokesman tells me that Young was a little late in returning to Washington on Monday, so he missed the closed-door meeting where they came up with this plan, and now he doesn't have to vote on it, so he didn't issue a statement on it, or at least he hasn't as of this evening.
So what else is going on? Are any things planned over the next couple weeks that might directly impact Alaskans?
Well, maybe not directly. The House is working on two bills that would reverse or make it easier for Congress to undo some of Obama's environmental regulations, all his regulations, really. But the ones that are big for Alaska are environmental ones. And they are moving along with those bills. And they're expected to pass the House this week.
And then also potential repeals of Obama's health care policy.
At the moment, what they're working on is largely symbolic. They would have to pass more legislation later to undo the Obama health care plan. But that is certainly the direction they're heading now.
All right. And over on the Senate side, it sounds like Murkowski is making a move.
Well, she's making a literal move. She's moving her office. Senator Harry Reid is retiring, so that leaves his office open, and she is going to take his office. And interesting note, that is the former office of Senator Ted Stevens. So Murkowski will be in Stevens's old office.
So people visiting might get to retrace some of their old steps. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Anne.
That was APRN's Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. 2016 ended with a Bering Sea storm that brought snow, ocean surges, and strong winds to many communities in western Alaska and caused some severe damage in Savoonga. St. Lawrence Island was hit by high winds and some flooding. Curtis Seelup is the mayor of Gamble on the northwest tip of the island. He says they only experienced minor damage because they were prepared and set up sandbags to prevent flooding. Cell phone service and phone lines went down temporarily, but the community's power remained on throughout the weekend. However, he says Savoonga, the community to the east of Gamble, didn't fare as well. Seelup traveled to the neighboring community over the weekend and witnessed the damage. Phone lines in Savoonga were down Tuesday, and KNOM in Nome was unable to make contact with the city office. Seelup reports intense winds blew the roofs off of buildings in Savoonga and swept debris through the town. The total extent of the damage is still unclear, but Seelup says agents from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, are expected to visit the community this weekend to do an assessment. Attorneys from both sides in the Pebble debate want a federal judge to temporarily halt proceedings in a long-running legal dispute between the group behind the proposed Pebble mine and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The motion was made by attorneys for the EPA and for the Pebble Limited Partnership on Friday. It asks that proceedings in the case be halted until March 20th, at which time the parties would jointly propose how they wish to move forward. The motion states the two sides have been talking since August about ways to resolve the case. Pebble has alleged that the EPA worked with mine critics with a predetermined goal to block the project. Attorneys for the EPA have called the lawsuit a bid to undermine the agency's proposal to protect parts of the Bristol Bay region from development. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Baked Alaska. Communities across the state set records for a warm 2016.
The warmest year of record observed from Metlakatla to Barrow to Dutch Harbor.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business accounting and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
Canadian officials say they'll stop polluted mine water from entering a salmon-rich river that flows into southeast Alaska near Juneau. The work could include plugging up tunnels from British Columbia's decades-old Tulsiqua Chief mine. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tulsiqua Chief hasn't operated since 1957. Two companies tried to reopen it during the past 20 years, but both failed. That's left a legacy of acidic water carrying pollutants into the Tulsiqua River. It's a tributary of the Taku River, a key source of salmon caught in southeast Alaska. Provincial officials had told the latest developer, Chieftain Metals, to clean up the site. After the company went bankrupt last fall, British Columbia sent inspectors to see what had been done. But it wasn't much. Mines Minister Bill Bennett says a government contractor took care of improperly stored chemicals and petroleum products.
They were not able before freeze-up to do anything about the settling pond that exists beside the river that captures the runoff from the hill that the old mine was built into.
He says experts will look into plugging leaking mine tunnels to stop the discharges into the pond, which leaks into the river. If that's not practical, he says they'll look at other options.
Even though the water that's been tested by both Alaska and British Columbia has shown no negative impacts on aquatic organisms, it's still against our rules for that water to be flowing into the Tulsiqua River. So one way or the other, we have to stop it.
I think there is actually some good news here and a change from past practices.
Chris Zimmer is Alaska campaign director for the group Rivers Without Borders. He says the tests Bennett mentioned were faulty and inconclusive, and he's been calling for a cleanup for years.
In the past, BC was simply saying we're going to let the mining companies come in, develop the mine, and clean it up. And I think now Minister Bennett realizes that after two bankruptcies, that this mine isn't one that's going to be developed, and BC is now going to have to take responsibility for the cleanup.
British Columbia acknowledges a new company could take over the Tulsiqua Chief. It's in the hands of a Canadian firm that would like to recoup some of its investments. It could do that by selling the mine. But Bennett says such a developer would have to meet tighter standards.
We would need an ironclad commitment from any new buyer that they were going to do what's necessary immediately. And if we can't get that, then the government would act on the closure and remediation plan and just simply close the site down.
That's what transboundary mine activists, including Zimmer, want. But he says it's not as easy as it sounds.
Plugging up the mine to stop the movement of water is one thing. You could do that relatively cheaply and quickly. But the problem is eventually you will have cracks, water will start moving, and you'll be back to the acid mine drainage situation where you would need a water treatment plant.
And that would be costly. Chieftain did set up such a plant for a while, but determined it was too expensive to run without the mine opening and generating income. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Local Boundary Commission is seeking public comment on a petition to make Nikiski its own home rule city. If the petition is approved as written, the city of Nikiski will include nearly 5,500 square miles, an area slightly smaller than the state of Connecticut. The Peninsula Clarion reports that the group Citizens for Nikiski, Inc. has submitted a petition to the state for signature verification that proposes city limits follow the boundaries of the current Nikiski Fire and Emergency Service Area, which stretches across Cook Inlet to include the Alaska Native villages of Tionic and Beluga. An economic development group in Anchorage launched a new survey today to crowdsource how residents think the local economy should grow in the next 5 years. Pam Kovacol directs business development for the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. She says the survey is the first step in what's known as a comprehensive economic development strategy, or SEDS.
We're asking people very, very directly, you know, what do you think makes Anchorage's economy strong or weak? Or what do you think the opportunities and threats are?
She says they hope the tool will reveal something new. The survey closes in February and will be followed by AEDC soliciting input from community and industry groups in the coming months. AEDC hopes that after revisions, a final document will be ready in August or September. In addition to reaching out to familiar partners on conversations about economic development, AEDC is also making a push to target what it calls economically distressed areas of Anchorage. The designation comes from census information that identifies neighborhoods like Spinard, Fairview, and Mountain View as having high unemployment and low average incomes. Kevakal says AEDC is seeking community partners and groups working in those communities to get better results.
We will also use traditional methods like community council meetings, but we will also be reaching out to other leaders in those areas, so for other organizations that work closely in those neighborhoods who might have a better idea of how we can better reach more of an audience there than maybe traditionally we have before.
The said survey is available to residents online through February 3rd.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Things got a little heated in the Northern Lynn Canal last year. Both Haines and Skagway experienced the warmest year of record in 2016, and they're not alone. As KHNS's Abby Collins reports, communities across Alaska felt above average temperatures.
The warmest year of record observed from Metlakatla to Barrow to Dutch Harbor and most places in between.
Rick Toman is the Climate Science and Services Manager at the National Weather Service in Alaska.
At least based on the data we have so far, every single long-term climate site in Alaska had a top 3 year, and the majority, 2016, is the warmest year of record.
Haines and Skagway are both in that category. For each community, the National Weather Service doesn't have a long, continuous record of observations. But the information they do have dates back more than a century. They're able to use the available data and information from other communities to make these kinds of determinations confidently.
In this case, for northernmost southeast, we do have the case where we have observations from at least either Haines or Skagway in some of the very warmest years.
In Haines, the average temperature in 2016 was 44.3 degrees, the highest ever recorded, about 3.1 degrees above average.
That doesn't sound like very much, but looking at a whole year, that's a very substantial departure. And in fact, it is over half a degree warmer than the second warmest year, for which we have nearly complete observations for Haines.
That second warmest year in Haines was in 1981. In Skagway, Toman says the average temperature last year was 44.8 degrees.
That's just about 3 degrees above normal. And the previous warmest year for Skagway was 1926 with an average of 44.4. So the 2016 exceeded that by almost half a degree. And that 1926 was an exceptionally warm year over nearly all of Alaska. So the fact that Skagway exceeded that in 2016 is a good sign that really there are no warmer years in the last century plus in the area.
Last year's warm temperatures did not come out of nowhere, and they're not unique to the Upper Lynn Canal. Here's Toman.
The last couple of years have been very warm across southeast Alaska, and it's certainly part of the very long-term trend. Of course, there's considerable year-to-year variability. It's not quite as dramatic as in other places in Alaska where changes in sea ice, for instance, are really driving temperatures up. We don't have those kind of issues for southeast. but certainly part of the long-term trend.
Another factor Thoman looks at is precipitation.
Precipitation for 2016 for Haynes was above average, about 117% of normal, but certainly nowhere near records.
But it was a significant year compared to other areas around the state.
From the statewide perspective, one of the most interesting things is northern southeast was one of the few areas that was actually snowier than average during 2016 up at the customs station. Of course, often one of the snowiest places in Alaska, almost the only place in the state that actually wound up with significantly above normal snowfall for 2016.
He's referring to the customs station on the Haynes Highway at the Canadian border. Right now, the preliminary data is available for specific locations around the state. Statewide and regional analysis will be released later this month. Reporting in Haynes, I'm Abby Collins.
Understanding physics may seem daunting, but mechanical engineer, writer, and musician Christine McKinley wants you to know it's all just chaos and it should be fun. The former Anchorage resident and author of Physics for Rockstars will be back in her childhood city for a science pub at the Taproot Public House on Sunday. McKinley acknowledges that in the past, there's been an educational bias against girls in science, engineering, and math career paths. But she told APRN's Lori Townsend that too often, the negative pressure starts with families, as she recently found while working on a park project in Portland.
I was doing some air measuring, and I had this little tool in hand, and there was this maybe three-year-old girl who was really interested in what I was doing, so I showed her the instrument, and her grandma was sitting there, and the little girl asked me what I did, and I told her I was an engineer, and I said, you might want to be an engineer, and the grandma interrupted and said, oh, no, that's too much math for you.
Ouch.
She's 3 years old. Let her decide. So I think math is hard for everybody, and to our sons, we maybe say, you know, you got to keep plugging away. This is important, and to our daughters, we go, oh, that's okay. You don't have to do that.
There's a big push for the STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, math. It's being promoted as the best path for jobs of the future. You were talking about that when you were saying you wanted to see what would be a good career path for yourself. Do you see this engaging young women as much as young men in this new kind of push for these STEM courses?
Well, I know there's some great attention being paid now to get young women to at least consider STEM fields. And that's all I ever want to do. It's odd to me that it's about 7% of mechanical engineers are women. And that hasn't changed much since I graduated from college forever ago. So I would just hope that with all the STEM information out there, that everyone, boys and girls, choose the thing that they're best at. So if that means that you are going to be an innovative fashion designer, great, go do it. Or an engineer, go do it. But I think that what we've done in the past decades is we've just missed getting the message out to everybody.
If everything we do creates more chaos, how should we think about the impact of our actions? Or should we not get paranoid about how we may be affecting other things?
I think if what we can practice and we can become really good at is sort of pulling out the camera lens. If you're sort of watching a movie of your life, the ability and just the practice of like, let's pull out and look at a wide view. What am I doing that affects everybody and everything around me? And then be able to go, yeah, okay, I can live with that. And then focus back in on your everyday actions. Just that action of sort of pulling back and focusing back in is a very mature and grown up and thoughtful action. If we were to just use physics, if only just to practice that, that would be a good enough use for some people.
What else will you focus on during your presentation at the Science Pub? What are you hoping to convey and have people take away from it?
What I would love is I know that the people that go to the Science Pub, they're very educated. I mean, I'm going to be speaking to people with PhDs. I'll be speaking to people that maybe never took a physics course. So I've got both ends. And in order to keep everybody engaged, what I think I need to do is for the people that have PhDs and already understand the laws of energy inside and out, give them ideas and ways to speak to non-physics people about these ideas. So I'm hoping that if I present this in a way that's funny and sticky and maybe new to a science person, that they'll know how to then be a good science missionary to people who aren't, maybe, who didn't take physics. And of course, for the people who are just there drinking beer and don't know what I'm doing there, I hope that they will, it'll just pique their curiosity. Like, oh, I thought I wasn't a physics and math person, but this sounds interesting. This I could get into.
Your book is titled Physics for Rockstars, Making the Laws of the Universe Work for You. How do we do that, Christine? I think a lot of us could use a little bit of universal assistance.
Yeah, I think I really truly believe this. I know it sounds a little bit kooky, like I'm starting a cult, but I really truly believe that if you understand the laws, just the basic, you know, what you learn in high school physics, the basic laws of motion and energy and gravity, then you start to learn a way of thinking that helps you navigate your personal life, your dating life, your what you wear. I truly believe that. And in the book, I also give examples that you can use if you are a rock star or a secret agent or a fashion model, ways that you can apply physics to stay out of trouble.
All right. Well, my last question, Christine, is what are your thoughts about infinity? Are things infinite or not?
Yes, things are infinite. Yeah. Yeah, and like many, you know, like many other concepts that are sort of scientific in nature, it's also just a human question. It's one of those riddles that just almost paralyzes our brain, and there are plenty more of those in modern physics.
Mechanical engineer Christine McKinley is a self-described thermodynamics geek. She's the author of Physics for Rockstars, Making the Laws of the Universe Work for You. And she'll be speaking at the Science Pub at the Taproot Public House on Sunday the 8th at 4 p.m. She was speaking with APRN's Lori Townsend. Happy birthday, Alaska. On this day, 58 years ago, Alaska officially became the nation's 49th state. On January 3, 1959, 6 months after President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed the Alaska Statehood Act, the last frontier joined the Union. Prior to that, for 92 years, Alaska had been a U.S. territory after being purchased from Russia in 1867 for a total of just $7.2 million, or about 2 cents per acre. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. With reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Abby Collins in Haines, and Lori Townsend, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.